Peggy Orenstein had mixed feelings about motherhood. She liked other people's children, but wasn't sure she wanted any of her own. Then everything changed. But having a baby wasn't as simple as she'd hoped. Orenstein writes about her quest for a baby in the memoir Waiting for Daisy. She told Steve Paulson she was ambivalent for years about having children.
You know, the truth is, I don't know that I ever knew fully that I wanted to have a baby. But the first time we decided that we were going to have a baby, my husband Stephen and I, we were flying 35,000 feet above Fresno. You know, I had been ambivalent. I had been avoiding the conversation. We'd been married 5 years. I had just turned 35. We had had a lot of loss in our lives. We were on the way back, actually, from his father's funeral. And he turned to me and said, you know, we're not part of the life cycle. And where there's so much death, there should be life. And I think we should have a baby. And I said, okay. Something about that just tipped the scales in my heart, although I immediately began to backpedal and say, but I have to finish my book and I have to do this much reporting. And so I was always kind of equivocating. But we did decide then. And then about 6 weeks after that, I was actually diagnosed with breast cancer. So that sort of set us off course.
Yeah. But what it sounds like is that you had thought about this decision for years. I mean, in fact, you had agonized about it.
Yeah, I was chronically ambivalent. It wasn't that I didn't want to have children. Or at least I don't think that's what it was. But I think correctly, looking at what happened to women's lives when they had kids and what motherhood, it wasn't kids, it was sort of the institution of motherhood that was bedeviling me. I think I wasn't wrong. I was seeing my friends either being subsumed by motherhood and dropping everything else or being sort of harried and resentful and trying to do everything and their husbands not doing so much. And I looked at those and I thought, geez, my life is really good. I loved my husband. I still love my husband. We were traveling. We were having a good time. I had just published my first book. It was going really well. I just didn't see why I would want to change all that.
Well, how did you get past that feeling that to have kids would trap you in a certain role of motherhood that you didn't want, particularly as you looked at your friends who were professionals and maybe they had kids and, you know, it seemed like it took them off on a track that wasn't right. Now, how did you get past that way of thinking?
You can continue to feel ambivalent even as you're pursuing these extreme measures to have a baby. So even as I was shooting myself up with the urine of postmenopausal nuns, the fertility drugs, and doing all these things, I was still thinking, geez, I hope I really want this once I have it. So I was at once desperate to have it and also kind of afraid of it. And I don't think I fully got past that until it was a reality and I had a child and saw how our lives were going to work. And I'm fortunate for me, for the way that I live, that we really do things together. My husband and I were both self-employed and both artistic types, and so we have a real free flow of how we take care of our daughter, and that really works for us.
Did you also start to feel the clock ticking? I mean, you were in your mid-30s, then your late-30s, no child yet. How important a part was that?
Well, the aging factor is pretty big. I mean, I had always thought, okay, if I wait until I'm 35, when we decided, I had just turned 35, and I thought, yeah, that's probably time. You know, I wasn't deluded. I didn't think it was going to be easy to have a baby if I was 40. But then you get stuck in this bind where you're getting older and it's not working. And I had some things intervene, such as the cancer and miscarriage. And suddenly I was 38. And you think, well, am I going to put my faith in my body and hope that this works? Or am I going to put my faith in science and start doing the infertility stuff? Because the infertility stuff, the pills and the shots and the IVF and all of it, gets less effective as a woman ages. So you have this little window that was rapidly shutting, and you have to make a decision, which way are you going to go with it?
Now, you've mentioned a couple of things. Cancer. What happened there?
I was 35 years old, had no reason to think that I had any predisposition for cancer, and I just got a mammogram as part of clearing the decks to have a baby, and it was at that time sometimes mammograms were given to women that young, and it was sort of fluky that the mammogram actually caught the cancer. I wouldn't advocate people have mammograms at 35, but it did, and I was very lucky. It was a low-grade, slow-growing cancer that could be treated pretty easily as far as, you know, we know, with lumpectomy and radiation. So my first thought, actually, when I was diagnosed, aside from how can this be, I eat organic broccoli. Well, first was, I'm going to die. And once I got over that probably wasn't going to happen, it was, am I going to be able to have a baby? And that became sort of the dominant thought.
So then, I mean, you had made the decision at a certain point, you and your husband, to try to have a baby. But then it turned out to be very difficult. At what point did you start to look for fertility help?
Well, we got delayed because of the cancer. And then we actually did get pregnant within 8 months and had a kind of miscarriage that had some complications for me. So we had to wait another year. So by the time we were starting again, I was, I think, 37 and a half. And you do start counting in half birthdays again. You know, for the first time since you were 5 years old, you're saying, I'm 37 and a half. I'm 37 and three quarters. So we didn't try very long that second time around, frankly. And I do look back on that and think about that. We really only tried a few months, and my hormone levels were kind of freaky. And my doctor suggested Clomid. And Clomid is a pill. You take it 5 days a month. It's not very expensive. It's supposed to make bigger, better ovulations. It also turned me into an absolute raving lunatic. They don't tell you that part. I was dumb. You know, I it was just like something took over my head, and I was just crazy. And we did that. I was crazy for 6 months.
Well, and there's some rather bizarre aspects of this track, too. I mean, you mentioned injecting yourself with the urine from menopausal Italian nuns.
Yes, postmenopausal Italian nuns.
Okay, tell me about
that. Does
that
sound odd to you?
Yes, it rather.
That's what it's actually now not really made of that anymore. But that's what fertility drugs, Pergonal, I think, was made of that, and the one that I took was also used to be made of that, because postmenopausal women excrete a hormone in their urine that kind of jazzes up your ovulation in this kind of futile attempt to revive their ovulation. And the best one-stop shopping for postmenopausal urine would be retirement convents, and there's a lot of them in Italy. So I guess, I don't know, they get a stained glass window, we get pregnant. I don't know. I don't know how they justify it. I don't know how they gather it. You know, I think, how do they get the pee exactly? I don't know. And then the other drug I took was synthesized from Chinese hamster eggs. And again, Chinese, I don't know why. Chinese hamsters. Why not some other kind of hamster? I don't know.
Now, you ended up getting pregnant again and had another miscarriage, and I think you were in Tokyo at this point. That must have been really difficult.
Yeah, you know, we did all that infertility stuff, and none of it worked. And, you know, this was an incredible strain on our marriage, and the whole thing was, and I do want to say that I think more than anything, more than a story about infertility or trying to have a baby even, I think waiting for Daisy is the story of a marriage and what can happen when two people who really love each other become unable to reach one another, and how you find your way back again, if you can find your way back again. And we really loved each other and really love each other, but man, we came very close to the breaking point. And at one of those points, I got a grant to go off to Tokyo and do a story. And I found out after I was there that I was pregnant, and I was very excited about that. And then I lost the fetus, and that was really, really hard, you know, alone in a foreign country. I didn't speak the language. But it also gave me this incredible opportunity. There is a ritual you can perform in Japan. You can make an offering to a bodhisattva, an enlightened being called Jizo, who watches over children and miscarried and aborted fetuses and children who have died, and guides them into their next life. And so I went off to make an offering to Jizo. And it was really, it didn't make it all better, but it was an incredible experience and incredibly moving, and made me realize that there is nothing like that in the West.
Right. Well, that's so interesting, because we don't have words. We don't have a concept for that in-between state, you know.
Well, or even for these, it's hard to even talk about. You say miscarried or aborted fetus. I mean, that's such a clunky thing to say. They call it a mizuko, which means water child. And so the idea is, in Japanese Buddhism, is that you flow into being, and you don't actually completely solidify till you're 7 years old. You're still sort of watery until then. And then starting at 60, you flow back out, and you go into these primordial waters where Jizo is, and he will guide you into the next place that you go, whether it's back to the same woman or to somebody else. And I found that immensely comforting, and it gave me language to talk about it and a context in which to think about it and an act that I could perform to mark that this thing had happened. And I can't say it was a good experience, but it was a very, very helpful and profound experience. And I actually eventually, it took me a long time to, I felt very vulnerable about it and very crushed. But I eventually wrote a piece for the New York Times Magazine about the experience, which in a different form is in the book and is in Waiting for Daisy. And I got so many, I got hundreds of emails. I still get emails about that piece and people who have been carrying it around for 5 years in their wallet and all of these things. And that was when I thought about what it would mean to make myself so vulnerable again in Waiting for Daisy and put my life out there in the way that I did. I thought a lot about the response I'd had to that piece and how meaningful it had been to people.
So in the end, what happened?
Eventually, surprisingly, I could get pregnant. I had 3 miscarriages. And at one point, what one of my doctors said to me was, nobody can tell you that you, this was very far along the line, nobody will tell you that you can't get pregnant and have a baby. They shouldn't tell you that. This was my gynecologist, not one of the specialists. Nobody can tell you that you can't have a baby, but nobody can tell you that you will, and you just don't know. And you at some point have to decide what is more important, pregnancy or trying to have the baby or becoming a parent and parenting. And that had a profound effect on me when it became time to pursue adoption, you know, as an alternative that I could really go for and would have been happy with. So I think that becomes, that's a balance point for anybody who's going through this, who's going through infertility and things aren't working. At some point, you have to say, what is the point here? Is the point my getting pregnant, which is how you start to feel, particularly the infertility industry and doctors make you feel that way, or is the point having a family and parenting and building your family and moving on with your life?
Now, earlier you were talking about the ambivalence that you felt before you ever had a baby, before you even decided to try to get pregnant, and now you do have a child. Do you feel like you're just a different person now? Because, you know, once you have children, then all that ambivalence goes out the window. And I would guess it's sort of hard to remember back to who you were back then.
Oh, I have been so surprised by how much I feel transformed. And I don't mean that for better or worse, just different. I was, you know, I find myself saying things like, if you don't drink your milk, you know, or eat your peas, or, and I just, these things come out of my mouth and I think, where did this, I mean, it comes, it sounds like, I sound like my mother.
Peggy Orenstein is a journalist who's written for The New York Times, Salon, and The New Yorker. Her memoir is called Waiting for Daisy.